Welcome everyone to the Farm CPA podcast presented by Top Producer. Today I'm joined by Brian Mitchell, who I think, if I remember right, Brian, you're about as far west and as far south in Kansas as you can get. Now, I know you can go a little bit farther, but do I have that right, or whereabouts are you located?
You are about spot on, Paul. We're on the in the very southwest corner of Kansas on the Oklahoma border. We're 9 miles from Colorado, 45 from Texas, and 60 from New Mexico, and really close to nothing. So it sounds a little better than it is, but yeah, right in that corner.
Well, I've driven through that corner, so you're right. You're not too far from nothing. I mean, you're not exactly nothing, but you're not too far away. So
well, they always said that we're not at the edge of the earth, but it's 7 miles west of here. So that's kind of where it's at. So.
But I know that you and I have been at the dinner table at Top Producer Dinners a couple times. I enjoyed talking with you and your dad. So I'm actually looking forward to this podcast today.
Well, good. Yes, we've had a lot of good conversations. I hope having a couple of CPAs together in there, we don't geek everybody out too much. But, you know, that we do what we got to do.
You know, I've been accused of not being a normal CPA. I'm not sure if that's a good thing or not, but definitely people have said, you know, Paul, you don't strike me as the normal CPA, especially when I talk about, you know, driving 175 miles an hour on my motorcycle and a few other things. They're like, we just don't view CPAs as doing that. But let's go ahead and get started with the podcast. Just go through a little bit of your early years, your educational background. Let's start off with that.
Okay. Well, I was born and raised here in Elkhart, Kansas. I graduated from high school in 1982. Back in the 80s, you know, times were tough in the farm. And so I wanted to, the farm economy is pretty rough. So I wanted to get completely away from farming. So that meant I chose Kansas University over Kansas State. Yep. I went to KU, graduated in 1986 with degrees in accounting and business administration. Then I went to work for Arthur Young, and as a fellow CPA, that really dates me there. Arthur Young, it's now Ernst & Young now, but worked in the tax department and obtained my CPA, had enough of the Big Eight of corporate accounting, and came back to our family farm and business in 1988.
Okay. And were you in the Kansas City Arthur Young office?
Or you know, I had a lot of friends in the Kansas City. At the time, I knew I was probably going to come back to the family farm. So I ended up going to the Wichita office, which Kansas City was 8 hours from home and Wichita was about 4.5. So I was able to do quite a bit of running home on the weekends and stuff. So had a lot of friends in the Kansas City office, no doubt.
Yeah. In, you know, I started from called Moss Adams, which is not as big as Arthur Young. I think it's like the 14th largest firm. And then, of course, now I'm with, you know, principal of CLA, and I think we're number 8. Definitely we've grown in the last 10 years since I joined it. I think when I started, we were about $230 million revenue, and now we're about $1.4 billion. So it definitely has grown over the 10 years or so. Well, that's a little bit on your personal background. How about the sort of the background on the farm? What type of farm is it? Maybe the current size, how it's grown, and all that good stuff.
We, the farm itself, my grandfather did custom cutting back in the 50s and also owned a gas station in Ian, Oklahoma, and he would go out custom cutting. And he had a chance to rent his uncle's farm, had some land here actually in the Oklahoma Panhandles, all dry land. So he came back and started renting that. Then my dad graduated from Oklahoma State University. He got a degree in accounting and served in the military and came back to the farm in 1964. And in 1965, we drilled our first irrigation well.
Okay.
And so that's where Dad had always wanted to go into cattle. But then when we started with the irrigation, that obviously took quite a bit of labor and effort. So we started getting the irrigation, and it was flood irrigation in the early years. And mostly we would grow irrigated corn and irrigated milo and some irrigated wheat, and then obviously rotate some dry land. Then until the farm grew. And then in 1988, when I came home, it was about 8,000 acres. And we started drilling wells and adding sprinklers and stuff and kept growing. So now we're sitting at about 35,000 acres right now. About 90% of it's owned. We have about half of it's irrigated. We've mostly irrigated corn's our biggest crop. We do got quite a bit of irrigated milo and a little bit of irrigated wheat, and then of course dry land. So we're kind of still got a lot of irrigated corn, but as the water levels, like a lot of irrigation places, we're and technology and stuff, we're being able to grow corn on less gallons per minute and yep. more efficient and stuff. So, but we are spreading it amongst corn and milo. But in this area out here, with the cattle feedlots and all the hog production and the dairies coming in, we're a grain deficit area. So there's plenty of places to go with the grain.
I'm just curious on your irrigated corn, what type of yield would you typically get in a normal year on irrigated corn in your area?
You know, where we're at right now, you know, last year was a really good year. We had yields from 220 to 270. This year they were out scouting a little bit of it with this. We had some heat coming in here at the end. We're going to be down probably 20 bushels an acre more on everything this year. So been lucky on the hail. We haven't had too much hail. So, but that's pretty much in there, the range. You know, we, again, when you have a lot of sprinklers on 500 gallons a minute to, you know, certain things, you start scaling back. And it, so like I say, it, but that's a pretty good range. And again, Mother Nature helps you, it'll be higher. But if, you know, just like everything else, you can put all the water you can on it and you have a dry year and you still can't, you know, it's tough.
Yeah, evaporation and so on. You know, the corn still appreciates Mother Nature dumping the right amount of rain at the right amount
Absolutely.
Of time.
You know, that rain from Mother Nature does so much better than the stuff we pump. I don't know what magic's in it, but it sure does a lot better.
Yeah, I was telling you offline, you know, out in our area, the dry land wheat, you know, we had a record crop last year too, sort of like you. You know, we certainly had wheat on dry land. We had wheat in the 170, 175 wow. range. A lot of 150s, 160s. And then this year, that wheat that did 160, 170 couldn't break 100, you know. So yeah. that was how bad our drought was. I'm just curious on your bases, when you say you have pretty good bases, what type of bases do you typically have in that area?
Well, it can get up to, you know, it'll vary depending on the demand, but you know, 50 over or sometimes depending on, again, you got feedlots, you've got silage, it depends on what particular, you know, way you want to deliver it. But they'll pick it up at the field. I mean, a lot of guys will even bag it on the side of the field and they'll pick it up. It can sure vary, but boy, when they need it, they'll come after it.
And, you know, as far as your staff, what type of staff do you have now as far as full-time and maybe part-time? You know, with that size of an operation, I would think you have a pretty good size staff working for you.
We usually have, we'll have anywhere from 12 to 14 full-time employees, and then we will hire our trucking. It's like everywhere else. You've got it, you know, everybody's it's pretty tough getting labor. And so we'll hire our trucking. We own our own combine, so we'll do our own harvesting side, but we'll hire our trucking just because we can't get enough help. Usually that amount will keep us. And then we'll have part-time. We'll have three to five to six people part-time helping the summertime and stuff. So, but then on the other side, our corporate office, we'll have three full-time staff up there. And then my dad and I don't know if dad counts for one. I may count for about a half.
now I'm guessing you're green. I mean, are you John Deere or are you a different color? I'm just curious, you know, a lot of it depends on the dealer network too.
We're very lucky in our, in our town, we have an excellent John Deere dealer and an excellent Case IH dealer. And so we try and support both of them where we can. Now, right now on the combines and tractors, we are green, but our Case IH dealer also has a big irrigation shop. So we try and support them on other parts of equipment and everything else. So because, you know, both those dealerships, they provide a lot of jobs for our towns.
Yep.
So,
yeah.
We're very lucky. There's not too many small towns that probably have two good dealers like that.
Yeah, no, I know in our area, you know, I grew up in Wawa, and there's a John Deere dealer there, but it's not really, in my opinion, that good, that big. It seems like they spend more time on turf and, in the hobby farmer than they do on the bigger farmers. And then the Case IH is really being supported. It's sort of a satellite office. It really is supported out of a dealership that's 100 miles away. So it's just tough to find two good, like you say, really good dealers, both on Case IH and John Deere, all in the same town. So now, definitely your farm operation has grown over the years. I guess looking back on it, what do you think you guys did that was right? What did you do wrong? And is there anything really that you'd want to do over?
You know, as entrepreneurs, I think the things we did right is we took advantage of the opportunities, you know, when they arose. And so the interesting thing I like to tell people is that sometimes I don't judge our success on the deals we have made. I feel fortunate on the deals we missed. And I keep a list of it. And obviously, I think we're going to talk about some other things here later. But I've got a running list of things that we had bid on and what the prices were and what we didn't get. And I go back and look at that several times, and I'm almost more thankful for that than some of the things we did.
Yeah.
But as far as doing anything wrong, you know, I guess the way that I was just watching a farm show this morning, record price of land, the 22,000 that just sold. And I guess if anything, you look back and go, man, why didn't I buy more stuff when it was cheaper?
Yeah.
So, but no, as far as doing anything over, one of the things, I'm 57 now, but one of the things, priority I set, I mean, even as an entrepreneur, my family was always a priority. And I mean, I served on the school board. I'd rarely miss my kids' ball games. I was in a band with my son for 5 years. We were playing gigs all over the place. And so when my kids left for college, I had no regrets about spending so much time working and missing out on family time. So, you know, that's one of the things that I'm so thankful that even, you know, business success, it's one thing, but family success is more important.
Oh, definitely agree. Being a CPA, you know, we do during tax season, especially in a tax CPA, I put in long hours. But I don't think I missed very many basketball games, football games, rugby. My youngest son was a rugby player for 3 years, and I don't think I missed one of those. I did miss his very best football game because I was up hiking in the mountains. That wasn't work related, but
I can say you can't blame that on the job there.
No, that was, and actually I think, and he was a defensive lineman, but he had a fumble recovery. He had an interception. I guess I saw it on TV, but that was about it. So yeah. I'm sort of mad that I missed that, but, well, we're going to go ahead and take a sponsor break right now. So we'll be back to, continue our conversation with Brian, but we'll go ahead and take a break right now.
Get timely updates about taxation, accounting, succession planning, and other issues that are unique to farmers and agribusiness processors. Find out about major agribusiness events and how to comply with new laws that affect your business. Subscribe to Farm CPA at blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness and experience the CLA promise. blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness.
Welcome everyone back to the Farm CPA podcast presented by Top Producer. I'm your host, Paul Niefer, and we're going to continue our conversation with Brian Mitchell from Elkhart, Kansas. Now, Brian, we were talking about, you know, sort of the growth of the farm operation, what you did right, what you did wrong. I think, like you said, one of the things you did right is sort of not end up doing something that in hindsight might have been the wrong thing. But, you know, you did sort of branch out away from the farm business and you've gone into what I would call the theater business. So I think our audience would definitely like to understand, how did that happen? You know, where you're at now. We certainly know with the COVID pandemic, theater business has been hit. But I think everybody's going to be very curious to just hear how you actually got into this and so on.
Well, gee, Paul, bringing up a theater business at COVID, you're just kind of like kicking my dog, aren't you?
Well, you knew we were going to talk about it. So,
owning theaters and COVID, how could you have any worse investment? Is that which column do I put that in? But our family, most of my grandparents, we've always on the entrepreneurial side. We've always had residential real estate, commercial real estate, and banking and other investments. But business, as far as I obviously back in business school and stuff, you talk about diversifying. And most ag businesses, they diversify in livestock or growing other crops and stuff. We just always diversified out of ag. And believe it or not, I can sum up how we got into movie theaters is basically Seaboard Farms. And you're probably going, what the heck has that got to do with anything? Which Seaboard is obviously a big shipping and packing plant company and stuff. Well, in the mid-90s, Seaboard announced they were putting in a pork packing plant in Guymon, Oklahoma, which is 45 miles from here. And as entrepreneurs, we were like, how can we take advantage of this? Because we knew there was going to be huge growth in the area. So, but like I said earlier, out here, even before Seaboard came in, is mostly the feedlots and stuff. So there wasn't a lot of confined animal feeding operations around here in the mid-90s. And so we looked at it and looked at their deals, and they, they would have, they were good deals. I mean, there was no reason a person wouldn't want to jump into them, but that just wasn't really our thing. So then we thought, well, gosh, how else, Guymon's going to grow, how else are we going to take advantage of it? And so we looked, and there was a big shopping center in Guymon. And again, we dealt in real estate. And so a bank had repossessed it. And so we thought, well, heck, we'll buy that shopping center. And anyway, we got in a bidding war. And actually, as come think of it, as a developer out of Kansas City won the bid on it. And so we thought, okay, well, we're not going to do that. Well, in the meantime, we're still looking. Well, in the meantime, Seaboard was having trouble getting contract growers, because again, that just wasn't something that was very common right here. So then Seaboard turned around and goes, you know what? We're just going to build our own houses. And so they came in and started and buying thousands and thousands of acres of farm ground, just started building their own hog houses. And they were going to feed, I think there's 16,000 hogs a day is what they process at that plant. And so they were going to literally almost try and grow all their own supply right here in the area. And so we just watched them start buying up land all around us. And so then what happened was they came back and said, hey, you know what? We decided we don't want to keep the capital in the, we just want to keep the hog houses and enough water rights, but we don't want to keep the investment in the land. So we turned around and bought a lot of that ground back that they had purchased. And so we ended up working together. It was a really good partnership. And in one particular area, we've got underground line and sprinklers and hog houses, and it's all tied together 6 miles one way and 4 miles the other and stuff. And so anyway, we started getting involved with Seaboard, and then we were seeing how the growth was going to do. So we just had done this project with Seaboard. And next thing you know, the bank calls back and said, well, the Kansas City developer couldn't raise money on the shopping center. Would you want to buy it? And so it was funny because my grandpa and I were here, and my dad had left, had to go somewhere that day. And so the bank calls us that morning, and grandpa and I was like, well, shoot, yeah, let's throw in a bid. So we did, not really thought about it. And so dad, wherever he was going, this was almost pre-cell phone, wherever he was going, he stopped and called back. And the darn bank called back that afternoon and said, how do we want the deed? So I was like, oh my gosh,
now you got to raise the money.
But dad's like, well, I'm never going to leave you two alone again. So, but anyway, so then you get, so we've got a shopping center and we need to, and it was about, gosh, I think it was 60-70% occupied. So it's like, how can we increase traffic? And so clearly looking around at other shopping centers and stuff. And I mean, it wasn't a big city shopping center, but it was a pretty good size for a smaller town. It's like, hey, let's build a movie theater. And so there was a little two screen there in town, and we went to the people because we didn't want to build something and put a local business under. So we said, hey, why don't you come in with us and we'll partner up. And he didn't have the capital to do anything, and said, let's partner up on this. Let's build a movie theater. So we ended up looking around, ended up building a 5-screen theater. and it did so well that we went ahead and added another three screens. That was back when stadium seating was just coming in. So, boy, we had the stadium seating and everything. So anyway, we thought, okay, cool. We've got a theater. And so at one point it was doing so well that instead of being partners, he said, hey, why don't you just let me lease it? And this ended up being one of the best things that ever happened to us is he said, why don't you just let me lease it and let's don't be partners anymore. And it's like, okay, fine. We got enough stuff going on. Well, I was down in Amarillo, Texas. This was, I think, the fourth or fifth year that had been open. And my wife, we were at a breast cancer. She was had her first chemotherapy for breast cancer. And so I was sitting in the doctor's office in Amarillo, and I get a phone call. And they said the state of Oklahoma just came in and shut down that movie theater for failure to pay back sales tax of $145,000.
Oh, man.
And so I'm like, gee, why does all this good news come at once here? So... and my wife is fine. So just add that in. She's doing well. And so, so then all of a sudden I have these, theater chains start calling us wanting to lease the theater. And I thought, well, heck, if they think it's a good deal, maybe we ought to just jump in and run it ourselves. So, cause we already own the facility. We already own some of the equipment anyway, helping them out. So I made a deal with the, because we didn't owe the money because they were the sole tenant. And so I talked to the lawyers of the state of Oklahoma. We talked to the bankers and ended up buying their part out and worked in there. We got it released from sales tax. So we had our theater. So we thought, okay, well, that's good. We've got our shopping center, our theater, and that's all it's going to be. And this was 2005. Well, in 2006, you know, that was the earlier days of the internet. I don't know exactly when we'd call the earliest days, but you know, that was when the internet was starting to come in and we were able to use it more and more. And, you know, back then, of course, what would we have been? We'd been about 15 years younger, Paul, you and I, but that, you know, when the internet first came out, most middle-aged guys like us, a lot of time we got in trouble with porn websites and stuff like that. Well, my problem was real estate websites. So I'm on there looking, and there was a shopping center that Chubb Insurance owned north of Wichita, Kansas, and had a movie theater in it. And so we hopped in the plane, flew up there and actually made a bid on it and got it. So we had two shopping centers and we remodeled the theater and two movie theaters. And so we thought that was going to be our business model, was be a shopping center and then have the movie theater, which is always a big anchor. And that way you're not held hostage to, you know, to one of your anchors. Yeah. And so again, that's how our thinking sometimes goes. Okay, that's it. We're done. And then of course, recession of 08, 09 came around, and man, then boy, you could buy about any shopping center in the country. I mean, when that recession hit, everything was for sale, it seemed like it. And so that's several things on my list, Paul, that I'm glad that those deals we were bidding on, I'm glad we didn't get. Who knew Amazon and them would come on like they did and on the shopping centers. And so anyway, then we shifted about 2 or 3 years later, then Hollywood decided they want everybody to convert to digital projection. And so those digital projectors run anywhere from 70 to 100,000 a piece, depending on, you know, the size of projector and stuff. And there was a lot of companies out there that didn't want to step up and make that conversion. And so that's when all of a sudden, boom, all these theaters came up all over, and we were able to buy quite a few of them in about 2 to 3 years. So that's kind of how we got into it.
How many theaters do you have right now? And where are they? Are they concentrated in any one area, or I'm just curious on your footprint?
Right now, we've got 107 screens in 15 locations, and we go all the way from Nogales, Arizona, through Colorado, New Mexico, Kansas, Oklahoma, and we actually got one just south of where you're at right now, up in South Kansas City, Missouri.
Okay, and actually, I'm in Overland Park, so it's probably, and I'm headed over to Lee Summit. Speaking of real estate, you know, I've been involved. Let's see, this is my eighth mini storage in my life that I've been involved in as an owner. And we actually, oops, hold on, my earplug fell out. We ended up purchasing buying into a new mini storage, and we have an open house today. So we got the city officials and so on and all that good stuff. So that's happening in about an hour. But
well, congratulations. That's it's a good area. A lot of stuff going on there.
And the one thing I can say about mini storage is the eighth, well, I'm not sure about the eighth, but the other seven, never lost any money on them. So that's that's sort of nice. So
they're COVID proof, huh?
Well, yeah, you know, because people, you know, during COVID, they bought a lot of toys and now they got to store them. So
There you go.
Well, that's definitely interesting. You know, hopefully this pandemic gets behind us and we try to get a little bit back to normal, whatever that normal might be. And I can tell you, time right now, it's almost like it's BC, you know, before COVID and AC after COVID. Yeah. I'll say, well, I met that person last year, and then I go, oh no, it had to be 2 years ago because last year I wasn't around anywhere. So,
months.
Yeah, I'm just sort of curious. It sounds like, you know, your granddad sort of got the operation started, then your dad has certainly expanded. You've expanded it. As far as succession, how has that been working? You know, has it really been transferred from your dad, or are you still partners with your dad? And then maybe for your generation that's coming up, it sounds like they're still in college or fairly young, but how's that process going?
Well, my grandpa, he passed away when he was 95, and he went in the rest home the last year, but every day dad would go up and get him and he would sign out going to work. And so, and a couple of his older brothers lived to be 103 and 104. And so, dad's only 82. So no, he's not even allowed to retire. He's still out here working every day. And, you know, pre-COVID, a couple of years ago, he had colon cancer, and he was up at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester for 3 weeks and had surgery and stuff. And so, you know, he was up there for 3 weeks. So I had to do what a person needed to do. I had to dock his pay because, you know, you can't let a guy take off like that, or, you know, he'll be doing it all the time. So, but no, he's dad. Now we've always been a family business. I've got a brother, of course, me and my wife, and then my brother and his wife live in Wichita, and he's a tax attorney. And then my sister and her husband live in Amarillo, and her husband's a senior vice president, commercial loan officer at a bank there. And so my dad's 82 and mom's 80 and still very active. And like I said, just going full blast. And so, we're still involved, family wise, ownerships in the theaters, ownerships in land. So the ownership side is still very much family, even though I'm the primary. Dad and I are the primary ones back here on the operation stuff. But as far as day-to-day stuff, but, you know, I probably, and this is one of the things that's tough to think, that more than likely, you know, there's not going to be any fourth generation on the farm. You know, it's just my two kids. My son is a extremely talented musician and out in L.A., an recording engineer. And that's his passion. And that's what he needs to do. And he's doing very well. My daughter right now is in Kansas City and working at a Insight Global and doing very well and graduating strategic communications. And so, you know, I don't see them being a part of it. And they grew up here. My brothers' kids grew up in Wichita, my sister's down in Amarillo. So it's kind of one of those things. As an entrepreneur, you go, wow, maybe, you know, you have to face that reality.
Yeah.
And so what it may be, at least on the farm side, is, you know, we could lease it out to other farmers at some point. We could, we've got a great group of employees that have been with us a long time. And some of them, we've kind of helped them. They're started farming on their own. They've got some of their own farmland, their own cattle. And of course we trade out and help things out. And so who knows, they may lease some of it out to them, you know, or at some point they may sell it. I don't know. It's just one of those things that, you know, you sit there and worry about that, but like dad and I, we could worry about it, or we could just get up every day and enjoy what we're doing and help everybody out and go on. Now the theater side, maybe where our family goes on, because as far as the family business, because we've got some of this next generation that graduated, and we've got bankers and people in real estate and corporate and stuff. So that's a possibility there, but it's one of those things that I used to worry about that a lot, worry about succession, you know, and somebody, I don't know, a long time ago said, you know, agriculture as a an independent farmer. No, agriculture as a whole is a very important industry, but any single producer is expendable.
Yeah,
because you know the ground just goes to someone else. So you can sit there and worry about your legacy and stuff, or you can and worry yourself to death, or just you know you're just gonna have to you Forrest Gump it. You take it how it comes, and you know if that's the way it's meant to be, that's the way it'll be.
Yeah, you sort of have to embrace the change. You know, you
absolutely.
Just can't. You know, you were sort of mentioning your kids maybe don't want to come back to farming. My two oldest boys both started a PwC in downtown LA, and after a few years, they decided being a CPA wasn't for them. One is now in real estate, and the problem with that is getting me in all these deals, and then I have to do all the tax returns for them. And then my other son is a professional daily fantasy sports player and podcaster, and actually, I think it's sort of interesting. I find out, well, how'd you do today? And then some days it's good, and some days it's bad, just like farming. So,
Well, you know, it's just back to if you don't enjoy what you do, I mean, life's too short to be stuck in something you don't want to do. And if you don't enjoy doing it, you're not going to be successful at it. And,
exactly.
And so, you know, it's one of those things where our farm's not any more special than anybody else's. And if it lasts another generation, great. If it isn't, hey, it's been a great run.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, since we are CPAs and we can be a little nerdy about this, I'm just curious, you know, we have the Biden proposals. We got I call it the progressive proposals on, especially on the estate tax, and I always cringe every time I hear the word eliminating step up in basis. Well, right now there's no proposal in Congress to eliminate step up in basis. The proposal is we want you to pay a tax to get a step up in basis. So I'm just curious, is that something you think that would dramatically affect your family, or you think like anything else over time, you're able to mitigate it and so on? I'm just curious what your thoughts are.
You know, it's interesting because this morning on CNBC Squawk Box, they were actually talking about it and, you know, talking about the tax on the unrecognized gains. And, you know, it, of course, again, it's back to any more, you know, back in the day, if you had proposals come out of Washington, you would think, okay, at some point they'll probably become law. Now you almost like, I don't care what it is. It probably, you know, you don't know if it'll ever become law.
Yep,
or not.
Exactly.
But even they said this morning, even as I see, it was Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, the former senator up there. She was talking about even the Democrats are leaning against it now. And, you know, of course, if you look at it the way it's written at the moment, at this minute anyway, you know, if it stays in the family, it's not taxed until it is sold. And so, of course, it can change and stuff. So, again, that's back to the same deal, just like the exemptions it used to be. There was X amount of exemption per spouse, and you had to deed stuff enough to get enough in each estate. Well, now that's kind of all combined. So, and then whoever was lucky enough, it was 2010 when there was no estate tax. I think George Steinbrenner, the Yankees, died that year, and no estate tax. So you could, you know, it's just you can only plan so much.
He conveniently died, I think, like January 5th or 4th. I think his family, I think they put him on ice for a few days just to
get maybe that's
to 2010.
you know, it's just, until you see it. And the thing is, too, you just try and stay flexible. And like a lot of the stuff we do, we will. You just do it through deeding, and like, you know, if we have a piece of ground that several of us own, and everybody has a minority interest, and so that way, whenever it's valued for state tax purposes, it'll be at a discounted value. You know, and you just got to do certain things like that you know is going to hold through whatever tax laws there are.
There's just
no way you can completely beat it. You just do what you can, and like I say, and I've got an uncle right now that lives in Hutchinson, Kansas, that he's going to be 100 his 100th birthday is in December. And he's like, dang, he's fine. But, you know, you start thinking at that age, man, what if I'm going to outlive my money?
Yeah.
You know, and stuff. And so So, and of course, we rented a reception hall for him. We're going to have a little banquet and a dinner and stuff for him. But we keep asking him, said, how you feeling? Because, you know, if we need to put a refundable deposit on the room, you know, because if he dies before then, you know, we want to get our money back. But you know, again, you just, or I've had my other grandparents were out living their life insurance policies.
And so,
you know, and the Wall Street Journal, I was trying to think how it was about 6 or 8 months ago. They were talking about the life expectancy of people our age could actually be 110 or so. So, you know, how do you plan for living that long? And so, again, you just, I guess maybe that's the older you get, the, you just can't, you realize you can't plan as much as you think you can.
No. And, you know, it's sort of curious, you know, I have four boys and I think one time they were there, I think a couple of them, there's a couple of them that are empathetic and there's a couple of them maybe not so empathetic. And I think one time one of the boys said, hey, mom and dad, you know, when it's your time, we're going to do like the Eskimos. We're going to float you out on sea on an iceberg and we'll just let you go that way. So we want to make sure we deal with the other two boys and leave those alone. But
absolutely.
You know, I always tend to end my podcast with a couple questions. I'll ask the first one, and then what keeps you up at night? You've already sort of mentioned a little bit maybe earlier on as far as that succession, but is there anything that sort of keeps you up at night that you worry about?
You know, it's kind of back to when I was thinking about that and back early, and I know there's, you know, other farms that have gone more generations. We're the third generation here. And when I came back, you know, they always, especially in this area, was, you know, everybody would talk about you live shirt sleeve to shirt sleeve for three generations, and said the first generation is the one that was truly poor and worked hard and started to see some success. The second generation, you know, grew up with modest means and but then was able to take it and achieve more success. And third generation grows up spoiled and loses it.
Yep.
And so I, you know, in my earlier days, that was always my worry is, oh my gosh, I'm going to do all this and you know, and lose something, you know. But then again, as you get older and like I say, back to my wife having breast cancer, I had prostate cancer. So, I mean, you start going through these health issues and start realizing, and we're all good and we're all fine. But when you go through it and you meet people at the Mayo clinics and things like that, you just start getting your perspective a little different.
Yep.
And so the things that keep you up at night are a lot different than they were in the earlier days.
Yep.
But I will admit COVID has, if anything, the last 18 months, COVID has kept me a lot of sleep, not quite as restful nights anyway. So.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's true of a lot of people. Although it's been interesting, you know, certain industries, including our own industry, you know, the CPA industry, I think almost every CPA I talked to basically had a record year last year just because of all the stimulus and we had to account for it and we had to help people. And because they had money, they were able to pay us. You know, we were thinking, well, we're never going to get paid. But that's that, you know, that was probably more the exception than the norm.
It's back to like we talked about being diversified and all the stuff we've got going on. And, you know, there's times the farm is down right now. It's the farm's up. It's doing great. So different things. But, you know, and when you look at the history of theaters, you know, the biggest challenge to the movie theaters was in the 1950s when television came out.
Yep.
People thought, oh my gosh, theater's going to disappear. Well, in the 80s, you had the VCR and HBO and stuff coming out, and we got through that. Well, today, streaming, that's the big issue, and shorter windows and everything. And it's gonna finally settle out. But, you know, one of the old-time theater people said, you know, everyone has a kitchen table, but they still want to go out to eat.
Yep.
And so no matter how nice your home system is, no matter how nice, you know, what movies streaming and stuff, people still like to get out and enjoy a movie with a crowd and popcorn and that kind of stuff. So it'll be fine.
There's lots of movies, you know, you'd rather see it on a 60-foot screen than a 60-inch screen. I mean, that's definitely true.
It's good. It's just now what you need to do this interview in about another year, and then maybe we can.
I think we probably might arrange that. You know, if I keep doing this podcast, you know, actually, I think yesterday's podcast was the 20th of these that I've done. I can't believe I've already done 20 of them, and but we're trying to do them every week. And so far, every Tuesday, we've gotten one out. So, and I have a couple in the hopper, so we're in good shape. Yeah. And then, you know, the last question I always ask is, you know, what is your definition of success in farming?
You know, I thought about that quite a bit, and I've heard on the other podcasts, and a lot of the people we've interviewed, we've met, and good guys, good people. And I guess for me, to me, and we've kind of alluded to it today, but success is a moving target.
Yep.
And, you know, defined by one's age and stage in life. And, you know, early goals of asset and wealth accumulation have been replaced for me over time. Family, health, friends, community, and contentment have become much more important. You know, achieving success without a sense of purpose is just meaningless.
Yeah. Totally agree. I being a CPA, I've met a lot of people over my career, and I'm going to tell you, my most miserable clients are the ones that never earned it. You know, they just end up, they're wealthy, but they never earned it. They just don't have any feeling of an anchor, no feeling of accomplishing something. And so I think it's important to make sure that we understand, you know, in life, there are things more important than the money, certainly the family.
Absolutely.
Well, again, Brian, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast today. I think we will try to reschedule this for about a year, and hopefully by then, COVID's way behind us and the streaming wars are done.
Another thing, Paul, I was out in Vegas last weekend. We had a big CinemaCon convention. And so some of the film companies out there, and I'm trying to push them to do a superhero movie about a CPA. You know, that's what we need. We need a good superhero CPA out there. And so
I totally agree. You know, I'm a fairly voracious reader. I still read about 100, 150 books a year. And I like mysteries, you know, I like thrillers, mysteries, and so on. And there was a series back in the 1960s and 70s by an author called Emma Lathan, which really was two people. They just put their names together. And it was about this banker that went around the world solving murders. So we need to have a CPA that goes around the world solving murders.
Well, and also hunting down these terrorist IRS agents. You know, we
exactly.
Got to go for the easy, laugh, go for the easy kill on that one. So
actually, these days it's more like go after some of these states. You know, these states are worse than the IRS almost.
My gosh, yeah. Because I mean, and just throwing it out, New Mexico. You talk about theaters. New Mexico had us closed. We had three theaters in New Mexico shut down for 15 months. Let us open. But they wanted their property taxes when they were due.
Yeah. And they didn't want to reduce the property tax.
No, sir.
No. So, well, again, Brian, thank you very much. And we'll keep in touch. And like I say, we'll definitely redo this again in another year or so.
Sounds good, Paul. And good luck on your opening today.
Okay. Thanks. Again, this is the Farm CPA podcast presented by Top Producer. I'm Paul Niefer, your host, and we'll have another one next week. Thank you.